back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spitaro, and today we are continuing with our look at Camelot 3000. And anybody who's listening knows that that means Mr. Gene Hendricks is sitting on the other side of this line, waiting, just waiting with bated breath to talk to you about King Arthur's court in the 3000s. What's up, Gene?
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm really enjoying going through this with you, Paul, and I just can't wait for our next recording, you know?
I couldn't wait for this one, so and as soon as we're done with this one, I won't be able to wait for the next one. That's just the way it is. And you know, it just keeps... Go ahead, finish.
I was just going to say, the story just keeps ramping up every single issue. So
it does, and my lack of memory as to where it goes is just making that ramping up even better. Because if I had a true memory of everything that went on, it would make it a little less climactic. But yes. Not knowing where it's going to go just makes it more fun to go through. So today we're looking at issues 6 and 7. So we are hitting and crossing over the midpoint of our 12-issue miniseries. And as Gene just said, it just keeps ramping up. And each issue, I think it's an art or an art form that has been perfected in later days. But in the 1980s when this came out, I don't think this was as common of a practice. I think I mentioned before, we've seen this in like Why the Last Man and The Walking Dead, where each issue ends on kind of a cliffhanger that makes you not, you know, like I can't wait for the next issue. I think it makes it more easy to satisfy yourself by reading it in trade. But it also makes you anxious to get the next issue, which is, as if nothing else, as a retail outlet, DC Comics should be thrilled with when they put out a series that has that. But unlike The Walking Dead and Why the Last Man, if you're reading this on a once-a-month basis, I do think there's enough substance to each issue that you don't feel like you didn't get enough yet. You want more, but you do feel satisfied with what you have. Walking Dead and Why the Last Man, again, I enjoyed them very much. I don't want to downplay them. But if I didn't read them in trade, and I just read them 1 month at a time, I think I would have felt a little bit let down by the lack of forward movement in each issue.
Yeah, what's very interesting about this is it walks that line of you get a complete story of an event, let's say, in each issue, but you get the setup for the next issue in such a way that you want to just immediately go to that issue. So it's Mike W. Barr does an amazing job with breaking up his story. It's just terrific. But and I'm, you know, kind of forecasting my grade.
I think unless somebody shows us otherwise, we could just go on the record that we're like A's on everything. But occasionally we surprise everyone by coming up with an A+. But it really feels that way as we're doing this. So I'm not burying the lead, I guess. But it is a somewhat of an art form. And it has to be, you know, kind of not only acknowledged, but just appreciated. Because to give you that content and to give you something you're going to appreciate to that level and yet still have you hanging on the edge of your seat waiting for the next thing, that's not easy. That takes a very creative mind as far as I'm concerned. So I do think that Michael Barr and that he's done that really well. And I think Brian Bolland's pencils have just brought it all to life. So I want to give them equal credit in their own way, but just... I can't come up with enough superlatives. I really can't.
Right. Yeah, I'm right there with you. But before we, you know, go on wax Mike Barr's car too much, why don't we get into issue 6? What do you say?
I was just about to say that myself. That was my line.
All right. So we have Camelot 3000, issue number 6. Cover date is July 1983. The on sale date, April 7th, 1983. Story by Mike W. Barr. Pencils by Brian J. Bolland. The inks this time are by Bruce Patterson and Dick Giordano. Letters by John Costanza. Colors by Tatiana Wood. And the editor is Len Wein. On the cover, we have Superman holding the body of Supergirl. No, wait. I mean, Cyclops holding the body of Jean Grey. Sorry. It's really King Arthur holding the body of Guinevere. Behind them, all the knights are looking shocked at this turn of events. Inside, we have the title of Royal Funeral, and open on Austin's face as he asks Morgan why she should be believed. Morgan tries to appeal to Tristan's want to have a male body once more, but then reminds him of his former love, Isolde. This only serves to enrage Tristan, but Morgan solves that problem by actually doing what she promised and making Tristan male. It's only temporary, though. She is a trickster, after all. Tristan is returned to his regular body and still refuses to betray the Round Table. Morgan wishes him a good night with his knightly and maidenly virtues still intact. Morgan goes back to Jordan Matthews' office, where Jordan is about to interview an assistant. Morgan tells him that he will hire this applicant, as his previous choice had an accident in about 5 seconds. The applicant, Claire Lachlan, comes in, and the interview takes no time at all. Confused, Claire asks why, to which Jordan replies that someone put in a good word for her. Back on New Camelot, Merlin is finally telling Arthur that they are up against Morgan. Arthur reveals that she is the only enemy of his that he actually fears. Meanwhile, Lancelot and Guinevere are arguing over the wedding. Lancelot is adamant that the marriage must happen, and even though he loves her, they must be content with their memories. Lancelot then goes to Arthur and pledges that he shall protect Guinevere and that no hand but Arthur's shall touch her. Guinevere, though, goes to speak to Tristan. She asks the knight to be her attendant, which Tristan accepts as long as there is no dress involved. In the office of President Marks, which is apparently in the It Seemed Better Days Capitol building, Guinevere fills the president in on her marriage plans, including the location of the United Nations building. The president immediately gives this information to Jordan Matthew, suggesting that the aliens might do something to sabotage the ceremony, which they can't allow until Arthur lets them know of his battle plan. Jordan then calls said aliens, who have some kind of humanoid body in a cylinder. They tell him that it'll be ready in 48 hours, which is just when the wedding is supposed to happen. Convenient. Over the next 2 days, the world is obsessed with the coming wedding, putting the hype and merchandising of the Charles and Diana wedding to shame. Even in war-torn London, the news gives the people enough hope to fight back on individual level. The day arrives and the UN building is crowded. The king and queen greet the crowd and go to the ceremony. All is accomplished with suitable pomp and circumstance until they are pronounced man and wife. As they move in for the traditional kiss, Guinevere is shot by a sniper. The knights, except for Lancelot, immediately give chase while a paramedic pronounces the queen dead. As Arthur mourns, someone comes up behind him and says, "No." The knights find guard and ask if anyone has come that way. He nervously answers that no one has, but Galahad doesn't believe him and cuts his arm off. This isn't a guard, but some kind of construct that can change shape and regrow limbs. It takes down Galahad, Gawain, and Kay. Back in the main hall, Lancelot kneels beside Guinevere's body and prays that his life be taken for hers. It seems to work, as Lancelot passes out and Guinevere awakens. Luckily, it didn't take Lancelot's life, but Morgan does something to Claire, and she starts to walk towards the royals. Meanwhile, Percival is laid low by the creature, even though he gave a good showing. This leaves Tristan alone with the mutated Owen McAllister. Dun, dun, dun. He uses his shape-shifting powers to envelop his former bride, all the while talking about how they'll be together and start a family. Tristan drops a grenade that he was getting ready to use, but Tom picks it up and destroys the creature. Tom, once again, puts his foot in his mouth when Tristan is wishing for a male body. As the Defiant Knights are helped away, and Tristan looks over Percival, Claire comes forward and reveals that she is really Isolde. How's that for a cliffhanger?
The end.
And that will be it for the series.
Come back to see, to read Camelot 4000.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this one feels a little bit less self-contained because now we're starting to really feel like there's a history here. Not only the King Arthur and Knights Round Table history, but a history of this particular iteration of the group. So I don't know that, you know, I don't think this one works as a standalone issue. Whereas I think some of the early, I think any one of the earlier ones might have. I think you could have picked up any one of the earlier ones and it would have made you want to read more. I think this one might actually, if you hadn't read the other ones, might make you say, I don't know, this may not be for me. That's not to say it's not really good. I think that's really Mike W. Barr saying, if you haven't read the other ones, read them before you read this, because I'm not going to pander to you by putting all sorts of exposition to catch you up. And that's okay, because we are reading it in that order. But it's just kind of an observation that I was making. You know, it definitely works for me. I had some notes on it. The first note I made was that when Morgan Le Fay converts Tristan to a male body, all of a sudden he's able to bend that iron bar that he couldn't do as a female. So, you know, we definitely have not only the appearance difference and the genitalia difference, but we have a physical difference that he is, you know, literally much stronger as a man. So he would be a more, in all likelihood, a more effective knight based on that strength. And that's got to be one of the things, besides every other aspect of it, but that's got to be one of the things that's just working away at Tristan's mind, saying, you know, I'm not nearly as powerful as I should be.
Oh, yeah. And it helps to prove that it's not just an illusion that Morgan's casting it. Yes, I can actually transform you.
On the other hand, Morgan could easily not transform him, create an illusion, and then do something that makes it appear that he bent the bar.
Well, yes, but then you have the bent bar afterwards just as a, hey, guess what? You can't bend this back now. Aha.
Yeah.
You're not Sherlock Holmes rebending the poker after the guy threatened you.
No, totally plays into the frustration of Tristan.
Yeah, but you see Tristan's honor here, where he says, okay, yeah, you can. I know you can give me everything I ever want, but no, it's my honor is too much for that. You can ask anything else of me, but not this. And that's all the Morgan actually wants, so bye.
Yeah, and you know, obviously we learn later that, well, we'll talk about what we learn later anyway. But
yes.
Morgan has a plan with Isolde that will come into play to try and see if that honor can't be tainted a bit. Then my next note was I hadn't really taken as much note of it as I did here when Merlin is talking to Arthur. I have, you know, clearly seen how dismissive he is of others. But I notice here, you know, as he's talking to him, he has his back to him the entire time. And then that made me think about, well, you know what? I think most of the time he's been in conversations with people, the same thing has been done. So it is either that he has such contempt for other people and disregard for them that he can't be bothered to turn around and look them in the eye, or that he's creating even more of a poker face for himself by not even letting them see his face when he speaks.
Yeah, it's probably low column A, low column B, really. But I'm thinking because if you notice, in the second panel of that conversation, on page 7. You know, Merlin's got his back to him, but then when he mentions Morgan, there's a little red dot in Merlin's eye. So it's like, oh, you know, this is his devil sire coming through.
But that could also be the, I don't want you to see my face because I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah, and that, because if we're talking about the Merlin from Once in Future King, the novel, which the first part of it became Disney's Sword and Stone, Merlin was never giving a straight answer. It's all, no, Arthur, you figure it out on your own.
You know? Yeah.
And if Arthur could see his face, then there may be some clue there. So, like you said, he's just preserving his poker face. But it's also, I'm thinking half the time he's working on something. You know, you don't see his hands for most of this. So, okay, is he just fiddling with something and talking to Arthur kind of on the side, or you know, what's going on?
Yeah, no, I think you hit it on the head when you said it's a little from column A and a little from column B. And the I'm going to keep working on whatever I'm working on is showing a little bit of a disregard for whoever he's speaking to, that they're not worthy of his full attention, including Arthur.
Right. And you can tell that because he does a Godfather trick and leaves him with a horse head.
Yeah, I see that horse's head. In, looks like a horse's head in a file cabinet.
Yeah, it's just weird.
Yeah, well, I think that's just to show you that anywhere Merlin is, there's weird stuff that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a little bit of a foreshadowing where Lancelot, you know, swears that no hand will touch Guinevere but Arthur's, and we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, we believe that, don't we?
The president, do you think he's meant to be a caricature of someone specific? Now, the president at the time was Ronald Reagan. I don't see this being Ronald Reagan. So I'm not sure who it's supposed to be.
I don't know. There's some times when I can see Reagan in it, in the pencils. Like I'm on the top of page 12. You have the side view and then the view, the upshot. That looks kind of Reagan-esque.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm wondering, because we had in The Dark Knight, Frank Miller had just Reagan draped in the flag constantly, but didn't have a cowboy hat on him or anything. I think there were other comic artists which would show him like as a cowboy president and things like that. So it's,
I guess, and to be fair, Reagan did act in Death Valley Days, which was a Western.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it could be that. I think it's, if it is a caricature of Reagan, I think it's a little silly. But I don't want to get into political discussions. I'm just trying to figure out what they meant by it.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that it's, you know, they're trying to look at this like, oh, this is going to be the ultimate popular president in the future. It's someone who harkens back to our Wild West days and everything. And it just so happens that they said, yeah, maybe we'll use Reagan for a little bit of inspiration, but it's not a one-to-one. Definitely not.
So my last note was just about the construct in the chamber as they're getting ready. I was trying, you know, like as I'm reading it, I have no memory of all the details of when I've read this in the past. And I'm trying to remember, you know, oh, you know, what are they going to do? Okay, oh, it turns out they, you know, created this creature that can, you know, regenerate its limbs and all of that. And I did not have any memory that it was Owen McAllister until they make that reveal. So I thought that was a great reveal.
Oh, yeah, it's... But it's another thing where, you know, Jordan is tipping his hand a little too much. And, you know, we'll see in your issue that Morgan kind of slaps him down for that. But it's like, why are you constant people in a situation where all they're going to do is say, oh, that's obviously the someone from the UN Security Council doing it, well, you know, we should be suspicious of them.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, he's not he is definitely a blunt instrument in the way he plans his strategic moves.
Yeah,
he does not have any subtlety at all. And then, you know, the ending where it turns out to be Isolde is just a great cliffhanger again, because we saw Tristan's resolve, and now we're going to see it get tested.
But here's the other thing. What that indicates is, oh, we haven't awoken everyone yet. If Isolde is out there, who else is out there? Who else can be awoken?
Yeah, as we've discussed in the past, there were a heck of a lot of knights that are not accounted for, and yes. I'm sure, you know, I haven't read the source material, but I'm sure there's a lot of other characters besides knights that could potentially rear their heads if this had I'm not gonna say had merited, because it certainly merited it, if it had spawned a sequel, they could have brought more characters back, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, they potentially could have brought back Galahad's mother, because that's someone that, Lancelot fathered a child with. You bring her back, and now she and Guinevere are at odds. You know, a little more drama there. One thing in the art that I found very interesting is for the wedding, everyone is dressed to the nines, etc. But if you look at Arthur, and most of the knights have this little half-cape thing on their right-hand side. Lancelot has one with fleur-de-lis. That makes sense. Arthur's, you would think, now, if it's... There's no actual coat of arms for King Arthur, right? But if you look at the movie Excalibur, you would figure it's going to be a dragon. If you look at the Pendragon role-playing game, that's three lions. Or no, I'm sorry, it's three crowns, three lines of somebody else. This, it's a modified House of Windsor. So, King Charles II, his coat of arms is that exact coat of arms, except where there are the three lions, underneath there are three fleur-de-lis, which doesn't appear on the House of Windsor coat of arms. Hmm. But it's... Okay, so I guess Arthur is officially the heir of the House of Windsor. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's something I would not have known without you pointing it out to me. But that is interesting.
I know too much about heraldry. Not as much as my buddy Kurt, but I know a lot.
There is nothing wrong with knowing. Except to the point where it causes you any type of dilemma, there is no point where you can know too much. Anyway, those were all my notes. Unless you have anything else, I'm going straight A's across the board again, because this is just great.
Oh yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, the story, we already talked about Spurtle was with the story. The art, one thing I'm going to point out is the amount of emotion you get in the artwork, specifically when Lancelot goes to Arthur. I'm just going to use that page as an example. First, Arthur thinks it's Guinevere. Then Lancelot comes in. So when he sees Lancelot, you only see Arthur from the back. Then you see Arthur from the back in the next panel. Then you see his narrowed eyes. When he turns to Lancelot, his eyes are completely shadowed. So it's this is my anime knowledge coming in, but when you have the eyes shadowed in anime, manga, artwork like this, it's the emotions are closed off. It's like, oh, this is not a happy moment.
Well, Arthur is not ignorant of their history. He's right. Fully aware of what went on, even though he is clearly trying to just get past it and act as if history is not, you know, absolutely going to repeat itself. he's hopeful that it's not going to. In fact, that's, you know, I think he made it clear in the earlier issue when they set up the wedding that that's why he set up the wedding, to, you know, create a requirement or for Guinevere to be true to him, because without that marriage, she technically wasn't cheating on him. Even though, you know, I don't know anybody who was dating and thought, oh, you know what, my girlfriend could sleep with whoever they want, and it's not cheating because we're not married. But that's besides the point. Or the other way around. I don't even want to be sexist. Any woman who would think that about her husband or boyfriend or whatever, I just don't think that makes sense. But I think possibly the time of Arthurian legend, maybe that meant something more. You know, until you were actually committed to somebody, maybe you weren't.
I think Arthur mentioned it, and this was Merlin's retort, is if there's no marriage, there is no adultery. Because there's no, you know, unless you have the sacrament of marriage, you can't be sacrilegious and commit adultery.
So I guess the thing is to take it beyond the emotional level and turn it into a religious thing, make it a sin.
Yes.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah, but I agree with you. Everything's an A on this one.
Okay, so we'll move on to issue number 7, which has a cover date of August of 1983. It was released on April 12th of 1983. It has the same creative team, except that we now have Terry Austin as an inker. And just for the record, Terry Austin, I think, is one of the greatest inkers of all time. But I will say there's one or two spots in this where I'm not crazy about the actual final product, and I don't know that it's the inking, I don't know that it's the penciling, but there's just one or two spots, and I'm not talking a significant number, but there are a couple of spots where I'm just thinking, I'm not crazy about that particular image. On a whole, I think it's, you know, I'm going to say up front, on a whole, it's pretty much consistent with everything that we've gotten before, except for one or two images. So the cover shows a tearful Lancelot and Guinevere walking towards the reader with their heads bowed. Arthur is in the background, accusatorily pointing at the two of them and banishing them. It's chapter 7 is titled Betrayal. We open the story with Arthur addressing his convalescing knights along with the queen, who is wearing the miniest of miniskirts. At this point, Sir Kay, Galahad, and who's the third knight?
Kay, Galahad, and Gawain.
Gawain. I wrote it so sloppily that I couldn't recognize it. So at this point, Sir Kay, Gawain, and Galahad are recovering in a sick bay of sorts. Tom is seeing to their needs and wondering where Tristan has gone. Meanwhile, Lancelot is overseeing some upgrades and being assisted by Neoman Sir Percival. Arthur tells Lancelot that he wants to have a war council with Lancelot and Merlin, and Guinevere indicates that she wants to be included. Her goodbye hand grasp with Lancelot does not go unnoticed by Arthur. Tom asks Lancelot about Tristan, but is pretty much ignored. From there, we join Tristan and Isolde, who have spent the night talking. Isolde pulls Tristan in for a passionate kiss, but Tristan breaks free and is tormented by being in a woman's body and unwilling to move forward in this way. Joining the war council, which is underway, a plan of action is being approved, but Merlin indicates that he will not be joining them for this offensive, as he needs to find and destroy Morgan Le Fay. Tom approaches Tristan, who dismisses him rather brusquely. We cut to Jordan, who is overseeing a planned assault on Camelot, which is stopped by Morgan, and he is warned to heed her, as her little monkey mascot was once a man as well. Meanwhile, Arthur and the knights are starting their own assault on the Neoman facility. Initially, they need to fend off the Neoman's aggressiveness until Percival takes charge of the Neoman. With their squad fortified by the Neoman, who are now following Neoman Percival, they break into the control area and quickly take it, and are also joined by the captive women and children, who were the families of the men who were transformed into the Neomen, and they were apparently targeted to be transformed themselves, and they indicate their crime was dissent. This scene is watched by Jordan, and an alien attack soon follows. But the knights repel it, while Arthur thinks of his words from a long ago, on the day of his coronation. Through the history of this earth, the strong have had their way. I pledge the dawn of a new day, when strength shall be used not for its own ends, but to protect the weak, to crush the wrong, to serve the right. The victory is celebrated, and the refugees are transported to a safe place while the knights return to New Camelot. There, Guinevere professes her love for Lancelot, and they make love, but are confronted by Arthur, who expresses his anguish that they have failed in their second chance and banishes them from New Camelot. Heartbroken, Arthur just wants to be left alone at this point. Cut to Tristan's quarters, where she sheepishly agrees to Morgan Le Fay's offer to transform her back to a man in exchange for betraying the Round Table, which is a huge cliffhanger as far as I'm concerned. We need to know what she's going to do to betray them. Is she playing Morgan Le Fay and going to double-cross her at some point? Is Morgan Le Fay playing Tristan and going to double-cross him at some point? There's just so much that could go on with this. And, you know, certainly, under no circumstances can you trust Morgan Le Fay to just make good on things.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a wonderful setup for the next issue, which we will not read until it's time to record the next episode. But, I mean, this whole thing is great. It's Arthur going to free the political prisoners and ending up with the Neo-Men on his side is just terrific. It's showing that they can get allies in just about any single place. But the reveal of Morgan saying, "Oh yeah, this thing here, that was a man once. So maybe I could have a second one if you keep this up."
Yeah. And the thing's got like a big smile on its face, which I just get a kick out of. as if it's happy to be a monkey man.
Yeah.
I'm going to just go to the two artwork choices that I thought were questionable just because I mentioned them and I don't want to leave them just dangling. Page 6, the first panel, Lancelot's face showing the obvious pain of Guinevere leaving. I just feel like that one is poorly done. I mean, it expresses what it's supposed to, but it just doesn't fit in with the rest of the artwork. It doesn't look right to me. And that one I'm putting on Terry Austin because I think that's more of an inking job than it is a penciling job. But I'm not crazy about that. The second one is one that I'm definitely putting on Bolland as the penciler. And that's when Arthur bursts in on Lancelot and Guinevere, where it looks like, you know, he's the Hulk bursting through a wall. You know, he should be coming through a door. Or he should be standing in a corner or something like that. He shouldn't be actually bursting through the wall, which is clearly what's happening because you can see the wall is all in shreds behind him.
Yeah, Arthur went in full Kool-Aid Man here.
Yeah, exactly. He could have burst in. Instead of just putting his fists out, he could have said, "Oh, yeah."
Yeah, but that's an interesting choice.
I mean, it does convey that he bursts in. That it isn't that there was no surreptitiousness. He didn't slowly walk in and discover them. He clearly knew they were there and just threw everything to the wind and said, "Screw it, I'm going right in there."
Yeah, but you could have the same effect if he had his hands up pushing the doors aside.
Yeah, or slamming the door open if it was a regular door, whatever it is.
Right. Yeah, anything but, yeah, that was just a very weird choice.
So that one, it's more the choice as opposed to the actual rendition, because it's drawn fine, I just don't think the choice is good. The first one with Lancelot's face, I just don't like the way it's drawn.
Yeah, I agree, that looks strange. I know what they were going for, and it kind of, what I have to wonder with that is because Guinevere passes him a note and that's what he's looking at. So the question is what's in that note that's making him make a face like this? It looks like the note's been some type of skunk smell from from the reaction. It doesn't. It looks more, oh, this is horrible, than anguish.
Well, I think it is anguish. I think it is supposed to be anguish.
I think it's supposed to be anguish. It doesn't look that way.
So the way I read it, and I think I really have to read it because I don't think you get it so much from the thing, is he just promised his that he was going to be true to Arthur. That he was going to, you know, do everything he needed to. And I think, you know, then when she must do something, give him something that says she's going to come in to meet him later or something along those lines. And then when she, you know, when she comes in the room, it's clearly her that's being the aggressor.
You mean where she drops her robe and is completely buck naked in front of him? Yeah, that's pretty aggressive.
Yeah, that's it. And he even says when she comes in, you know, Gwen, you shouldn't be here. I thought we decided, you know, like, and then he doesn't get to finish the statement. But clearly, you know, he wasn't, expecting to have, he was at least trying to resist.
Yeah, he was doing his best to avoid her. And she's forcing the issue, which is much like how it is in the movie Excalibur. Where she comes to find him out in the woods.
Yeah, that's true. Well, there is no question that, at least the way I understand the legend of King Arthur, that, you know, they are both complicit on the betrayal aspect of things. But here it is showing Lancelot is at least trying to make an effort to not do so, whereas Guinevere doesn't seem to really be putting much of an effort up.
No, although, you know, and it kind of makes me wonder. You know, obviously she has some type of feelings for Arthur, but is that just plain loyalty? Like, this is our best hope. I have to do everything I can to support him, but I don't love him. And she actually loves Lancelot. But even, you know, it's... She's upset at the end when they get banished, but I guess because Lancelot's the one that turns around and tries to apologize. Guinevere, I'm just wondering, okay, is she upset because she's banished and can't help anymore? Is she upset because she's going away from Arthur, or is she just upset that they got caught?
Yeah, it's not clear. I mean, she's in tears, but, you know, that doesn't mean... That doesn't mean she regrets what she did. It just means she's not happy with where she is at this moment. You know, whereas Lancelot, I believe, is clearly torn. And I think it is given a little bit of legs with the discussion... I'm sorry. With the discussion that he had with Tom in the previous issue, where he talked about, you know, he would do anything for Arthur, but this is love and he can't help himself. Basically,
right.
That is not a fair excuse, but it does at least indicate to you where his mind is at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, yeah. you can say all day that, you know, I'm not going to take this $10 million, but someone drops a suitcase in your lap with the cash. It's like, well, here it is.
Well, you know, there's times when things happen. I'm just trying to put it to real life. Nobody's ever put a suitcase for $10 million. But there's times when things happen and you say, well, this is what I was thinking. And there's times where it's like, well, that's no excuse. And it's like, well, no, I'm not trying to make an excuse. I'm just trying to explain what happened.
Right.
And I think that's kind of where Lancelot is. I don't think he's going to make an excuse. Because making an excuse is saying, oh, this isn't my fault, don't blame me. I don't think that's what he would be saying. I think he's going to be saying, you know, I couldn't help myself, I tried, but I failed. You know what I mean? I think he would take responsibility, but I think he is looking to just explain what went on. So I think there's a difference. It's a subtle difference, but it's a difference just the same. So it's they're both culpable, but I do see Lancelot as the more honorable of the two.
Yeah, I think he's the one that's more torn between the relationship with Arthur and with between him and Guinevere. He feels strongly in both directions.
Yeah, and I think we have a true love triangle here. I think mm-hmm. there is clearly a love, a non-sexual love, but a love between Arthur and Lancelot. I think they love each other as much as, you know, brothers possibly could. Again, you know, it's not a sexual thing, whereas with Guinevere, it's a sexual love or a love that's borne out by a sexual relationship. But I think with Lancelot and Arthur, I think the love and the connection that they feel is every bit as strong.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
So I think it's played well here. But the problem is, and just going back to it, the problem is you don't get the feeling that Guinevere really regrets what she did.
Not in here. No, she even when, you know, when Lancelot turns around to look back at Arthur, she's looking at Lancelot.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you feel, and you know, this is just the way it is. You feel like she felt she had to make a choice, Arthur or Lancelot, and she chose Lancelot.
Yeah.
It's not, I love them both equally, and I just couldn't help myself with either of them. It's, no, I've picked what I want. That's at least the feeling I get. And again, I don't remember where it goes from here. So there's things I could be saying that could totally get contradicted as this story goes on. I don't know. I don't remember.
Well,
but that's part of the...
We got five
the
more issues to find out.
Yeah, it's part of the joy of doing this, is I'm just really enjoying every second of going through these issues. And, you know, we'll get 3 more episodes out of this, and then I'll have it read, and then, you know what? I'm going to be sad that it's over again.
Yeah, but, you know, then, you know, we can revisit it sometime in 5-10 years, and
there you go.
And it'll be all fresh and new again. That's how my memory works.
it's the beauty of getting older, is that every comic is your first comic sometimes. So, all right. So, unless we have anything more on this one, I'm going to say, even with the 2 artistic blemishes that I found, I'm going to say it's still an A. If it didn't have those blemishes, it might have been an A+. I don't know. The story is an A+. And the cover. Cover's just an A. It's not an A+. It's, and I feel like it's damning it with faint praise. it's awesome. It's every issue. It's A+.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't gone to Mike's and seen what all the covers look like as like one big collage, because I don't want to. I read this fairly recently, but I don't remember the order things happen. So I don't want to spoil myself, but I can just picture all 12 of these as a big poster just hanging on my wall.
Yeah.
You're right. It's not, you know, it's not an A+, but they're all A or better. So, yeah, but I agree with all your rankings. It's the story just continues to be wonderful.
Absolutely. And once again, if I haven't said it before, I'm going to thank you again for getting me to reopen my eyes to this series, because I am enjoying the heck out of this. This is the kind of stuff that makes me want to podcast more.
Until we finish it, then it's like, ah, damn it, what's next?
All right. Thanks again, Gene, for coming on with me. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@2truefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the 2 True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.2truefreaks.com. 2 True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.